This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. More and more people are turning to meditation as a way to calm their nerves and live a more relaxed life. And author and journalist James Kingsland says you shouldn't be misguided. It's not just a spiritual practice, and it's not just for celebrities. In his new book, Siddhartha's Brain, he looks at the connection between this ancient practice and modern science. I recently spoke with James Kingsland about how meditation works and what its future looks like. James, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Mark.
Tell us about meditation. What is it, and how exactly does it work?
Okay, well, there are many different kinds of meditation, but what many of them have in common is that they involve focusing on a particular stimulus, whether that's the sensation of your breath entering and leaving the body, or the soles of your feet as you're walking, or a mantra as in transcendental meditation, or a movement as in yoga. And what all these things do is that they break the train of regular thoughts. And in doing that, they bring a sense of calm and focus. And the trick with all these things is to bring your attention back to the chosen sensation whenever your mind has started to wander. And that's really all part of the process, because everyone has wandering minds. And the trick is to notice when it's happening and to bring your attention back to the chosen focus without judging yourself.
So is focusing on a task like a hobby or woodworking or gardening, are those forms of meditation as well?
In a way they are, yes. Because the sense of calm and focus and fulfillment you get through doing those things, it's sometimes called a sense of flow, I believe. That's really no different from meditation, because what's happening is you're developing a state of indistractability and focus and concentration, which is very it's a pleasant feeling, and it's where all of us want to be, really, because when our minds wander, often it can be a quite distracting and unpleasant sensation, because our minds often wander to very negative self-referential thoughts.
So how exactly does meditation affect a person's brain?
Okay, well, what we've been finding is that it particularly affects a part of the brain called the default mode network, which is responsible for mind wandering. And what happens is that when people meditate, the principal hub of the default mode network, which is known as the posterior cingulate cortex, activity in that starts to go down. And the more people meditate, the more experienced they are at meditating, the quieter their default mode network becomes. And so that's really a sign that they're becoming less distractible, more focused, more calm. And so this seems to be the key part of the brain. Another part that becomes involved is called the insula, which is involved in the awareness of bodily sensations. And people who meditate, their insula becomes more active, and also the thickness of the cortex of the insula gets greater. And these are signs that they're learning to focus more on bodily sensations and visual and auditory sensations, rather than the contents of their mind, you know, the stream of thought that drives the rest of us crazy most of the time.
So you're saying the more someone does this, the more they practice at it, the better they get. So I shouldn't be too discouraged if I try it at first and say I'm having a really hard time staying in focus when I do this.
Yeah, that's what everybody says. I think everybody goes through that. And even quite experienced meditators find their minds wandering if they're tired, perhaps, or distracted by something. But it's all part of the process. Noticing that your mind has wandered is a sign of progress. It's not a sign of failure. So really what you have to do is persist and do a little every day. That's important. It can just be 5 minutes, but as long as you do it every day, and don't get dispirited if your mind wanders. It's all part of the learning process.
Now, we talked about how this affects a person's brain. How does meditation affect a person physically?
Physically, And there's a guy called Herbert Benson, who back in the 1970s discovered something called the relaxation response. And he found that when people meditate, when they break the train of regular thoughts, he found that their blood pressure goes down, their heart rate goes down, breathing rate goes down, their metabolism slows, and their muscles relax. And all these different physiological markers change simply when we focus on our breath or whatever it might be and break the train of regular thought.
What are the origins of meditation, James? How long has this been around?
Well, I think it's probably been around as long as humanity, as long as people have been able to stare into the flames of a fire, for example. You can imagine hunter-gatherers in the evening when the conversation dies down. You can imagine them gazing into the fire and becoming very, very focused on the flickering flames. And that's a kind of meditation, and they get themselves into a state of calm and focus. So it probably goes back even well before religion, before civilization even. But all religions at one time or another have practiced contemplation or meditation, whether that's the Sufis of Islam or the Christians, the Desert Fathers, did a lot of contemplation in isolation. And, of course, Hindus and Buddhists are still well known for their meditation practices.
Is it gaining more and more popularity in the U.S.?
It's growing and growing all the time, yes. And I think it's helped enormously by scientific studies, clinical research showing that it can benefit people who are prone to depression, who are prone to anxiety, and even people in the throes of addiction. There's some very good studies coming out about specially tailored mindfulness programs to help wean people off some quite serious drugs like cocaine and methamphetamine. So it's great that there's this convergence between spirituality, clinical science, psychology, and neuroscience.
Now, you're the science writer for The Guardian. What led you to start researching meditation?
Well, I'm actually no longer with The Guardian since last year. I left The Guardian in order to pursue this writing business full-time. What led me to investigate meditation was about 5 years ago, I discovered that there was a Buddhist temple, a Thai Buddhist temple, almost on my doorstep, just a few miles away in Wimbledon. And I had no idea it was there. I've lived in London for many years. I had no idea that it was there. And interestingly, this is the temple where Novak Djokovic, the tennis star, where he goes to meditate before the Wimbledon tennis tournament. And it seems to work well for him anyway. But so that was really my introduction to Buddhism. A friend took me to this temple. And I've always been amazed by the way monks and nuns give up so much to devote themselves to contemplation. I could never understand what they got out of it. They give up family, they give up sensual pleasures, they give up alcohol, all the other things we take for granted. And so I was interested to find out why they do that. What do they get out of it? And then I started to read up more about mindfulness and the scientific research that's been conducted, and it all started to come together, and the book really has come out of that.
Well, the title of your book is Siddhartha's Brain. So tell us who Siddhartha is.
Siddhartha was his full name was Siddhartha Gautama. He was a prince living in the 5th century BC. In northern India, near the border with Nepal. And he became the Buddha. He started out as an ordinary guy. He was lucky enough to be living in favorable circumstances, and his father protected him from all sorts of unpleasantness because he was afraid that he might pursue a spiritual career. But inevitably, he came across sickness, aging, and death, despite his father's best efforts. And he realized that there was something inherently unsatisfactory about life. And so he embarked on a six-year spiritual quest. He gave up his home and his family, and he began to meditate and relying on the kindness of others for things like food. But eventually, after 6 years, he finally attained enlightenment, and he became the man we now know as the Buddha.
So, James, what makes this ancient practice of meditation so important today when we have modern medicine to help us deal with many of our physical and mental health problems?
We're extremely lucky to have all those medical things at our disposal. I mean, we have antibiotics and painkillers, which, of course, they didn't have in the ancient world. But the interesting thing is that despite all our advantages, the advantages of medicine and the advantages of plentiful food and shelter, there's still this sense of dissatisfaction. And interestingly, since the 1950s, despite steadily rising GDP, in developed countries, levels of life satisfaction, levels of happiness, simply haven't improved. So there's sort of this dilemma at the heart of human existence, whereby despite having everything we could possibly need, that our bodies need, we still feel a sense of dissatisfaction. And that's where Buddhism and meditation come in. It's all about coming to an acceptance and accommodation with the realities of life, and learning to calm the mind and focus.
I'm talking with science and medical journalist James Kingsland. His new book is Siddhartha's Brain, Unlocking the Ancient Science of Enlightenment. James, is meditation just a spiritual practice? Do you have to adopt certain religious beliefs to practice meditation?
Absolutely not. No. In fact, most of the mindfulness courses that have been developed are completely secular. They're completely without religious content. So there's no need to believe in any god or to practice any particular religion to get the benefits of mindfulness. These things are universal. They're something that we can all benefit from, whether we have faith or whether we have no faith at all.
How tough is it to get started meditating? You always think about you have to find an absolutely quiet place. You have to find the perfect setting. But is that actually the case, or is this something that's accessible for just about anyone?
Well, to start with, it's important to find somewhere quiet where you won't be disturbed, because when we start out, we're very easily distracted. So, for example, when I started, I live in an apartment block, and I used to meditate immediately after breakfast. And the sound of my neighbors getting up and going about, making breakfast and stomping up and down in the apartment above me, I found that very distracting and very, very irritating. So it's good to find somewhere quiet and a quiet time when you won't be distracted. The wonderful thing is that after several months of practice, you'll find you're less distractible, and so those everyday noises will become less of a problem, and that's a sign of progress.
But it sounds like it's something that you could even do at work. Just shut the door to your office or whatever, and start meditating.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. You don't need to do it in a special place. As I say, it helps to be free of distractions. But when you get used to the practice, you can really do it anywhere. You can do it on the bus. You can do it when you're walking down the street, as you're standing in line at the supermarket. It's simply a question of focusing your attention on a bodily sensation, whether that's the sensation of the soles of your feet on the ground, whether it's the feeling of the fingers of your hand, or the sensation of the breath entering and leaving your body. You can do that anywhere, and it helps you to calm down and to focus.
James, what's the research show about how meditation affects the aging process? Can this actually slow down aging?
Well, it's interesting, but still tentative. Some of the latest research suggests that meditating increases the activity of an enzyme called telomerase, which is involved in rebuilding the ends of chromosomes. The wearing down of chromosomes is one of the key signs of aging in cells. So that's one sign. And the other benefit is that if you reduce chronic stress, you're likely to be less vulnerable to diseases such as heart disease, which are known to be closely connected to chronic stress. So that's another potential benefit. But as I say, these are still tentative findings. It would take a longitudinal study, I think, to find whether people who meditate live longer than people who don't meditate.
So what's the future of meditation look like?
Well, it's happening already. You can buy devices that are effectively electrode caps, which you fit on your head, and they monitor electrical activity in your brain to tell you how well you're doing in your meditation, whether you're hitting the right mental spot, as it were. And I can imagine in the future we could all be going to mind gyms that rather than exercising our muscles would exercise our minds. You'd pay your subscription and you'd go along before work, for example, and you'd fit one of these caps on your head and you'd go into the zone, you'd watch your brain activity on a screen in front of you, and that will help you to get to the right place. I mean, you mentioned earlier how difficult it can be sometimes to know whether you're doing it properly and to not be distracted. So these machines could help you do that. They could be a shortcut. So rather than having to practice for maybe decades before making very substantial progress, you could be fast-tracked by going to the mental gym.
Mind gym, that's an interesting thought. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Author and journalist James Kingsland, his new book is Siddhartha's Brain, Unlocking the Ancient Science of Enlightenment. Next up, we'll talk with the founder of a program to combat online harassment. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.